Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
So much richness. We have had an amazing conference with a variety of topics and presenters. I mean, unbelievable. So definitely support Forests Without Frontiers. They are really cool. Nicoletta Capiniano does amazing work. Yeah, and so I'd like to introduce you to Alina Roeder. She has her bachelor in cultural education and her master's in cognitive semiotics. She's a facilitator and just started her online business for intuition coaching. Since childhood, she knew how to listen to her body voices, a skill she thought would be normal. And growing up and being in close contact with children and teens, she observed how easily the body can be forgotten. The trend for disembodiment became her investigation topic of her master thesis, and the results she's going to present on this conference. So how can we forget our body? Traveling back in time, our Western civilizations was not always as detached from the body as we tend to be nowadays. In this presentation, Alina will take you on a journey following the search of philosophers and scientists to find an answer on what is human consciousness and how is it related to the human body. Referring to different studies, she will point out some possible reasons why we sometimes forget our body and why it could be good to stop doing so. Alina, I am super happy to be here and I'm really excited to hear more about it. So I'm super happy to have you over the world.
Thank you so much, Kath. I'm really happy as well. It's such a great honor to have the chance to speak here and yeah, to present you some of the results I found during my master thesis, which I did at the Aarhus University in Denmark in my master's in cognitive semiotics under the wings of Per Bundgaard. So if he's here, thank you so much for all your help, Per. And I'm really happy to take you on this little journey. So as you already said, first we are going to look at a little bit of history and the science and philosophy who were coming up with different theories. And in the second half, I'm going to show you some really interesting studies as well. So I'm going to share my screen. And then we can start. Can you see it? Yeah, perfect. Amazing. So welcome to this little journey on how we come, how it comes that we forget our body. It's a search for the origin of disembodiment. And everything kind of started with this gentleman. I'm sure you might know him. It's René Descartes, the guy who says, "I think, therefore I am." He said this in 1641, and since then, a huge change happened in how we connect mind and body and how we feel about mind and body connection in general. So René Descartes was the first one in modern history who was breaking with the former way of acquiring knowledge, namely the Aristotelian way of thinking, and they acquired knowledge totally through their experiences and through their senses. And he said, "Wait a second, I can't trust my senses. How come I'm never sure if I'm asleep or awake? I can't really say if a tower, which is a square tower, but it appears round when I look at it from the distance. So my senses are not trustworthy. I can't really tell if they are lying to me or not. So the only thing he was really sure about is that he's doubting. So he said, okay, I'm a doubting thing. I'm a thinking thing. That's how he called himself. So he came to the point to say, thinking is the main mode of the mind and of the self, and made this the main attribute of this substance. So he started to split up the human body into two substances, the thinking mind, and then the physical part, the body, which belongs to the material world and which is having the spatial extension as the main mode. So yeah, he said these are two different things, and I only know for certain that I have a thinking mind. So with this conclusion, he was sure that the mind must be superior to all the physical things happening in the world, and therefore also to the body. And yeah, he was the first one in modern philosophy and science to establish this distinction. And but he couldn't deny that there is an interaction between these two substances, so that the mind is having a clear influence on the body. For example, when he wanted to raise his arm, of course, his body was reacting and raised the arm. And when he felt hungry, his body was hungry. So he couldn't deny that there must be some form of interaction. So he said, okay, they are interacting, perfect. Then he got a critique from Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia, who wrote him a letter and said, "Dear Descartes, how is it possible that an unmaterial thing, the mind, which has no substance, can interact with a physical body, which is totally reliable or relying on the physical laws and is a physical substance? How is that possible that they are interacting?" And with this, she was the first one to establish or to really point out the mind-body problem. The mind-body problem is a problem because we have these four different claims which are found to be true in themselves, but they cannot all be true at the same time. So when we look at it, we have the first claim, which is that the body is a material and physical thing. So this is backed up by science and our own evidence. So we can look at DNA, for example, and we are following the physical laws. Sorry. So this is something we can claim to be true. The second claim, the mind is a spiritual and non-physical thing, is also something we can self-experience. And as there is no comparable material or object in the whole world that has these same attributes, we can claim that this must be something different than the material, so a non-physical thing. The third claim is that mind and body do interact. So as I said before, the mind is definitely having an influence on the body. When we decide to walk or to talk, to move, our body is reacting on it. And the other way around, if we, for example, take medicine or drugs, we alter our bodily state, but also our mind state. So there is a clear interaction between these two as well. The fourth claim, which Elizabeth of Bohemia pointed out, the physical and the non-physical cannot interact. So there is no material thing which can grasp physical features. For example, a brain scan can't show our thoughts. So the non-material mental forces cannot be displayed. And so this is a backup for this claim. And we can see that they are all, make sense in themselves, but they can't be true at the same time. So this is making up the mind-body problem, and it's still a problem nowadays. But there are different line of thoughts who were trying to solve it in one way or the other. So we had the dualism, which is founded by Descartes, where he said, okay, we have the two substances, mind and body are separate entities. But there's also another line of thought, which was the reaction to dualism, actually, which is called monism. in monism, it's believed that there is only one substance existing in the whole world. So there are two subcategories. One is called idealism, where it's believed that it's only the mental substance existing in the world. But as this has never been so prominent, I'm going to skip that part for now and focus more on the physical side, namely the physicalism, where it is said that the only substance existing in the whole world is a physical one. And this physicalism itself can be split up into two parts again as well. So we have the reductive physicalism side, where they say everything can be explained and therefore also reduced to physical things. So it can be explained in terms of physical properties and physical laws. So we can reduce whatever might be mental, it can be reduced there. One of the first theories who actually started this new way of thinking, so that there's only one property and that this can be reduced, was behaviorism. It was in the early 20th century where, J.B. Watson and Skinner were founding this stream. And there they said, the mind is only behavior. So it's part of the body, it can be reduced to the physical because it's nothing different than the behavior we see in other people and we can observe. So feelings and thoughts are seen only to be responses to external stimuli, and that these responses are shaped by the environment around us, the community we grow up in. So this is all. So the mind doesn't play any role because it's just the behavior. And with this, they kind of pulled out the mind from the private room, which Descartes established. So he has the mind only for himself and can only detect his thoughts as the only person. So it has to use introspection to tell about it. And here in behaviorism, they say, okay, no, the mind is nothing private anymore. We can see it publicly in the behavior of other people. So the mind is nothing separate from the body, it is the bodily behavior. During the two world wars, which were happening in the 20th century, there were lots of evidence coming up that the brain is actually having a huge influence on the behavior. So people who got back from war with brain damage were showing a different behavior than they did before. So this is a reason, or one of the main reasons, why behaviorism declined in its popularity and the mind-brain identity theory got a huge rise on this. So they say our mind is equal to brain states. So sensations and feelings and thoughts are nothing different than firing neurons. And with this, so for example, they say if you are feeling hungry, you're not feeling hungry, you're in a hungry kind of brain state, and this leads you to go and get some food from the fridge. So mental phenomena are nothing different than neuronal actions. And yeah, as already pointed out, this was supported by the evidence that people change behavior when they have a brain damage, but this can also be backed up with medicine, where we alter our bodily state and come into a different brain state. So these two parts are belonging to, or these two theories are famous examples of the reductive physicalism side, but there's also the non-reductive physicalism, who says, okay, you try to reduce the mind onto something physical, but it is more than the physical. This is why it's called non-reductive physicalism. And there we have the functionalism, which was also established during the mid 20th century. So kind of at the same time as the mind-brain identity theory. And functionalism says, okay, the mind is not only the brain and the brain activity, but it's the functional role the brain and the brain activity has. So it can't be reduced only to the firing of the neurons, but it actualizes these firings. It can be compared with being So the mind being the software of a computer, which is in this metaphor the body. So the mind is running our body. It's creating or is giving us the function. So as an example, it can be said, so when you feel pain, it's not the feeling pain, but it's the function of being a tissue damaging detector. So it tells you when something is damaging you. And this leads to the outcome that you scream or stop the situation from happening. So the body is only important in this theory to enable the mental and functional states. Yeah, looking at all these theories, moving from a separation between mind and body to having the mind as being behavior, seeing that it is actualized, or seeing it as the brain states, and then moving on to, no, it's not the brain states, it's a function of the brain states. We come now to the most up-to-date theory about the mind-body problem, namely the embodied cognition theory. Here it is said that the mind is emerging from the body. So the mind is part of the body and is dependent on the body, and they're interconnected with each other and can't exist without each other. But how can the mind be embodied? So we have our sensory motor system, which is the neural network in our brain, which is collecting all this information from us moving and feeling and touching and collecting all this perceptional input. And with all this information we collect from the environment, we can start to create image schemas in our mind. So image schemas are structures, perceived structures, structures of the perceived attributes in our environment. So for example, when we experience a physical boundary in our everyday life, for example, when we're in a room, then we feel what it is like to be in a room, and hence we get an understanding of what it is to be inside and to be outside. And due to this, we can then understand the more abstract and more mental level sentences like, oh, the boat is in the ocean. So we understand that the ocean is the container holding the boat, and then we know how it must feel like for the boat to be in the ocean, in the water, so in the room. So having the, this mental representation is only possible due to our physical experience of this. And these image schemas also allow us to create categories. These are mentally grouped objects with the same perceived attributes. For example, furniture is a great one, where we know, okay, we have a kitchen chair, but we also have more of a sofa chair thing. And all these have different attributes, but they kind of belong together. So we perceive them as kind of being connected. And the more specific we get with our categories, so for example, with a category chair, the more specific are the attributes we associate with it, and also the movement we activate in our brain when we think about a chair. So we automatically know, okay, I sit on it like this. So here again, we see that we experience physically how the world around us is, and then can start to mentally think about it. So only due to the experiences, this is possible. So we can say that the sensory motor system in our brain allows for understanding and recognition and identification, for meaning making. And these are all things which are associated with the mind. So in this way, the mind is embodied. And we can then say that the sensory motor system builds the bridge between our mind and our body, and also to the environment and to the outside world. So the sensory motor system is the key part here. But yeah, how come we tend to forget our body in everyday life? We see now that in history, the theories moved along from being a totally separation between mind and body and coming back and saying, like, wait, no, now we are on the up-to-date version mind and body are interconnected and on each other. So how come this is not reflected in our everyday life? So here's the first question. And yeah, Fiona, maybe we can start here with a poll where I would like to know from you guys, what do you think, what belief do most people hold in our Western society? Yeah, we have the options, a dualistic one where mind and body are separate units, or a unitarian one where mind and body are interrelated. So what do most people believe? I think maybe we have this running for around a minute. So just to see how everyone feels about it. And thank you, Arian, for putting the books into the chat. They're great examples, definitely. So, yes, we can close the poll. And most of you say, okay, it's a dualistic one. And this actually reflects what a lot of people think, but I will show you in a second. So when we move along with a presentation, so the belief about mind and body relation, we need to keep in mind that there are two ways of believing. So there's a distinguishing between the intuitive beliefs, which are based on personal experiences. They're flexible and very situational and mostly unconscious. So these are beliefs where you are waking up in the middle of the night and people are asking you a question. This is where intuitive beliefs are or can be seen. The other part is explicit beliefs. These are acquired and based on knowledge and on critical thinking. They're very stable and very predictable in a way, so very conscious. These are the beliefs which are called explicit. So I would like to ask you in the second poll, what do you think? Is dualism something we learn, or is it an intuitive belief? So Fiona, if you could help me with the second one. Perfect, thank you. So what do you think? Is dualism something we learn, or is it an intuitive belief? The answers are dualism is explicit belief or is an intuitive belief. So something learned or very intuitive. Yeah, so far most people think it's an explicit belief that we learn. Here we have it a little bit longer, if there's still someone who wants to answer. There's no right or wrong, so it's just a little fun thing in between. So you don't need to worry about giving a right or wrong answer. Great, but yeah, most of you think it's an explicit belief. And here in the following, I'm going to introduce you to some studies which will give us an answer on this. So studies investigating the theory of mind show that children get at the age of 4, actually, an understanding of unobservable mental states and physical objects. So for example, here in this Sally and false belief task, children are shown this task, and there is Sally who puts the ball into the basket, and Anne sees that and is sitting there. When Sally moves away, Anne is taking the ball out of the basket and puts it into the box. And then the kids are asked, okay, now Sally is back. What do you think, where will she be looking for the ball? So children under the age of 4, they don't understand that Sally doesn't have the knowledge they have. So they will say, she would look in the box because we know that the ball is in the box. But children at around the age of 4, they develop this theory of mind and understand, okay, Sally doesn't know this. So they get an idea about about the knowledge Sally has. So they will answer that she will look into the basket because this is where she was putting the ball before. And yeah, having this understanding of the immaterial mind, the invisible mind, and objects in the world is definitely a dualistic one. So we see we have the separation here. And it can be said that this might be an evolutionary skill we have. So it's an innate skill which helped us to predict others' behavior and others' goals and the emotions of other people, which pretty sure helped the people back in the days to survive better. And yeah, so this could be an explanation why we have this dualistic belief, but we can definitely claim, and this is also what Paul Bloom says, he wrote a whole book about it, that babies are natural born dualists. So not an explicit belief, but an intuitive one. Another study which was investigating the same topic, where preschool children were presented with a magically duplicated living hamster, found similar results actually. So they were asking the kids about their belief, and they said that the mental states are not copied to the same extent as the physical one. So yeah, they understand that the brain is needed for remembering, but they only see it as a tool they, or the mind, is using in order to do certain activities. So they connect the identity to the mind and not to the brain, which gets copied. So this is also a dualistic belief here, because they're connected to the immaterial mind and not to the physical brain. Here we come to the third question I have for you. What do you think is the dualistic belief caused by the Western culture? Yes, the Western culture is provoking the dualism, or no, the dualistic thinking exists everywhere on the planet? So let's see what you think. Yeah, so far more people vote on their Western thoughts provoking the dualism. Maybe we leave it a little bit longer. Yeah, so yes, I thought the same, but actually it's a little bit different. I will show you the according studies now. So when there was a study looking at the influence of the culture, they were comparing children from Canada and children from Fiji. And they were showing these children animated characters whose motion could be interpreted as being a mind-body switch, and ask them, okay, what do you think? What happened? And what happened about the mind? And yeah, we're testing their beliefs. And all these kids made intuitive dualistic inferences. So no matter if they were growing up in Fiji or Canada, they were thinking, okay, when the mind switches to a new, or the mind brain switches to a new body, then this must be dualistic. This is not, the mind is not connected to the physical brain. So it's switching the bodies. So this is definitely another proof for an early emerging dualism, as these kids were quite young. So between the age of 2 and 13. And yeah, this also points to universalism, so that dualism is not connected to the Western thought, but is something everyone or every human has innate. And there were actually also studies and physical evidence for having dualism prevalent in China already before 221 BC. So quite long ago, and it's still prevalent nowadays, which I find quite interesting. So I really thought the Eastern cultures might have a different take on this. But yeah, they are also dualists. My next question, the fourth one, what do you think? Can children outgrow the dualistic belief? So yes, when they get older, they are not dualists anymore, or no, the dualistic thinking is still present in adults. I know it's a tricky one. So far, most of you think that it's still present in adults. Yeah, and it stays like this. So 73% of you think it stays in the dualistic thinking. So maybe you draw from your own experiences here, maybe. But yeah, we'll show you studies regarding this. So the same study where I was just talking about, where they showed the kids with their, so the Fiji kids and the Canadian kids with their two animated characters, which were switching or having switching motions, could be understood understood as a mind-body switch. They also included some parents and adults from Fiji. And it was quite interesting that they found that compared to the Fiji kids, their adults are less dualistic. So this is definitely a sign that when you grow up, you might lose some of your dualistic stance. And it was wondered if this might be due to the Western influence, that the older Fijian people might have more contact with Western thought or media. But it is also shown that the Canadian children are less likely to be dualistic than the Fiji children. So this shows Western thought does not have anything to do with the dualism. And yeah, because the Canadians are obviously more induced in the Western thought than the Fiji children. So the Fiji children were most dualistic than the Canadian children, and then the Fiji adults were less dualistic. So there's evidence that it's not provoked by the Western culture, and that the dualistic stance is also getting less with age. So what do you think? Another little experiment also connected to the next study. What do you think? Are personal properties like physiological and biological features changing when a brain gets transplanted? Yes, because the mind is connected to the body, or no, because the mind is independent of the brain? Interesting. So far, we only have the yes answer, that the mind is connected to the brain, so that it will change when you have a brain transplant. Yeah, all of you think that. Nice. It's interesting, right? To think about how it would be to switch brains with someone. Yeah, and then we get a no. So, yeah, amazing. Thank you, Fiona, for that, Paul. So a study was actually using the same thought experiment as I was showing you just now. So they were looking at the answers of children and adults about the same question. So when a brain gets transplanted, are the personal features changing with the brain, or is it staying to the same person? And they had 60 children in different age ranges, namely from age 6 and age 10 and age 8 as well. So 6, 8, and 10, and the adults. And they found the result that the children at the age of 10 are having the same belief as the adults, which was less dualistic than the younger children. So they connected, so the children at age of 10 and the adults connected the identity with the brain, so like most of you did now, which gets transplanted, so that the identity and mind is therefore changing with the brain if it gets transplanted. And yeah, that was quite interesting to see. And the researchers did not really expect this result. So they were investigating what is happening with these children at around the age of 10. And they figured out that at this age, the kids get taught in school about the brain functions and the importance of the brain. So we can say that these children were outgrowing their intuitive dualistic belief because they learned in school about the brain. So they developed a more physicalist stance, which is an explicit belief. So yeah, you remember, right, where we were talking about the different beliefs. So they came from the intuitive one, and due to the knowledge, they got a more, less dualistic stance on the whole thing. Another study which looked at the intuitive responses of the adults is also quite interesting, because there they found that adults are still intuitive dualists. So even though they have the explicit knowledge and the explicit belief, which says, okay, no, the mind gets transferred to the brain, the intuitive part is still a dualistic one. So this shows that dualism might be the default mode of us humans. And they tested it in the way that they were priming the adults, please answer intuitively, so without lots of thinking and very quick. Or in another group, they demanded the cognitive ability. So they had to do some, I think it was math tasks, and remember their results while they were answering the question. So cognitively, they were in a totally different sphere. This is why they answered intuitively. And there it was shown that it was more dualistic than a physicalist stance. So knowledge can suppress the intuitive beliefs, but it can't replace it. So there are also studies definitely proving that, that this is possible. So yeah, intuitively, we are all dualists. And even though we can learn about it, this stays our intuitive response, which I find is quite interesting, looking at the science telling us that our mind and brain are super interconnected and the embodied cognition is relying on the body, but we are still intuitive dualists. So when we look at what kind of influences this dualistic belief on has on our everyday life, it is interesting to see that the dualistic belief has a negative influence on our health behavior. So people who, so that was a huge study with, I think, 1,700 people. They were testing how people think about health-related behavior. And the ones who were holding a dualistic belief were less engaged in physical health. So that means they were thinking, okay, my brain or my self, my mind is not connected to the body, but more detached. So no matter what I do with my body, it doesn't have an influence on my mental health. And on the contrary, people with unity beliefs, so who think that mind and body are closely interconnected, are more health oriented. So maybe that's interesting as a takeaway for today, to find out where you are standing and maybe to work on this a little bit. And yeah, I was also adding some areas that I feel are supporting the reinforcement of the emphasis in our society. So coming from the closer look at the human or at one person, where it says that we have negative health influences, we can zoom out and see that our society is actually building up on the dualism in many ways. For example, the education system is very much focused on the intellect and on our mind. So the body is kind of, yeah, just a thing to bring the intellect to school. I know these are very critical statements here now, but yeah, maybe this could be definitely a point where they could use some of the knowledge our embodied cognition theory is bringing in, so that it could have benefits, for example, for the meaning making and understanding of the children to better include the body. So I know that there are some school systems which are already more inclusive of the body. But yeah, also the body image in general is definitely influenced and negatively influenced by only focusing on the mind. So when we are not experiencing our body by feeling and moving ourselves, but rather experiencing ourselves due to the feedback we get from other people and only kind of get it in a cognitive sense, then we are more likely to have a negative body image and a fear that we need to compare us with others. And so this is definitely a point where I feel that embodiment can really help, especially children, to grow up with a healthy body image. And media and social media in general also fosters or enforces this comparison with others, and also technology in general. I mean, we all know it, we are all sitting on our phones, and now here, instead of having being in real contact, we are using this technology. I mean, the great way, especially nowadays, but it's still detaching us from our body. So we are mostly focusing on what our mind is doing, but instead of being in real physical contact. And yeah, these are, of course, can also start some negative feelings. And when we feel negative, for example, about ourselves, our body image, or feel negative because we compare us to other people on social media, or because we are sitting the whole day like looking down on our phone, this is a negative bodily feeling coming up. And yeah, some people tend to numb this with different strategies, for example, with alcohol, and yeah, suppressing the feelings with, I don't know, shopping is also, I guess, a very common one. So yeah, these are all things and areas where I feel that embodiment can definitely be a great, great help. And yeah, I'm very, very happy that this embodiment conference is actually happening, and is for free for 48 hours for everyone to watch. And this whole conference is giving you tools and strategies how you can closer connect your body with your mind and integrate them in your daily life, which will help you with enhanced mental health, but also general well-being. And as I said before, in the theory shows that you are having an easier way basically to create meaning of the world and to understand and recognize. So yeah, I'm thanking you a lot for your attention. This was my wrap up of my thesis. It was a shorter form, so if you would like to know more details and go more into depth, feel free to contact me in this email, and then I'm happily sending my thesis to you. Here down there, it's cited as well, so I hope that is fine with the university, but I guess it is, because yeah, I wrote it, so I hope it will be good. Yeah, that's it from me for now. I will stop sharing my screen. So, do we have some questions? I think there's still some time for questions.
This was very inspiring, Alina.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to hear.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you have questions, please feel free. I'm very happy to answer. But of course, if you like, you can also put in some of your thoughts about this, for example, areas where you feel that embodiment would be definitely needed. So yeah, let's get into discussion here in the last minutes.
Here's a question from Muriel Alexander. Mm-hmm. How do you work as a coach? What are your tools?
Interesting question, definitely. So I'm just getting started with my coaching business, and I'm still testing grounds and seeing how I can include my stance here that embodiment is definitely an amazing way to find meaning in the world. And so embodiment tools are great, or yeah, I'm working with them, or will be working with embodiment tools. So yeah, breath work is definitely one, and checking in with yourself, how you feel, and feeling in general. So moving the body is a great take on that, definitely, to tap onto your body wisdom in a way. But we also had some I think the channel yesterday was actually about embodied knowing. So there's more. If you're curious about it, you can check that out as well. And yeah, I'm happily letting you know as soon as my first workshop is out. It will be about decision making. So yeah, if you like, let me know in the email. If you're sending me one, then I'm happily sharing my infos with you.
We have Lisette. She's asking, she's asking, it seems that transplanting organs can also change someone's personality. What is your stance on that?
Yeah, I truly believe that. So I don't know, maybe you heard these stories as well. So when the heart got transplanted, that the person, yeah, got different characteristic due to which were connected to the old person who had the heart before. So I really feel that this is not just imagined, that this is real, and that our mind is so connected to our body that this is still something, or that this is something which gets transferred as well in one way or the other. So yeah, maybe if there's someone who has experiences or knows someone who has an organ or something transplanted, I'm happy to hear your experiences or thoughts on that. But I do believe that a part of our personality goes with the organ as well. Yeah.
Adrian is asking, are there cultural practices that make us less or more dualistic?
Oh, nice question. So I was actually looking into the part religion plays, in which definitely I think it counts as a cultural practice. And the religion, so the Western religion, I mean, mostly we are Christians here in the Western world. So I looked into the Christian religious practices, and it was very interesting that it's kind of building up on dualism. So a physicalist who believes that mind and body are closely interconnected and dependent on each other would never say that when you die, there's an afterlife, because the physicalist would have this stance that you, yeah, decrease when you die. But our religion is building up on the situation that we are dualists, an intuitive dualist. So we have the belief that there's an afterlife. So yeah, I think this has a double influence in both ways, that the dualism is reinforcing the belief in this religious practice, but also the other way around, that this also enforces our dualism in a way. But what is really interesting in that part is that we still say, oh, he was looking, he was watching me, or I heard him talking, even though he's dead, and that we really have a great rituals with the dead bodies, so that we bury them and give them our honor, that we go to the graves. So we still kind of feel, I guess, in a way, that the body is really important in this sense too, so that we are still honoring the body and talk in an embodied way about the lost ones. So yeah, I think this is, I don't know if that was an answer, but it was definitely going in this way. Ah yeah, and you posted a book. Yes, The Absent Body. Definitely interesting. Great. Thank you. So, and I think there was a question in the Q&A box as well, right? Ah no, it's answered already. Amazing. So yeah, if any of you, what do you think? What are the areas where you feel this is something you should bring embodiment in, or where it could be needed to have embodiment in? I'm curious, what do you think? So kind of connecting to my last slide, where do you feel we are too much in our mind and not enough in our body? Ursula says, whenever it comes to decision making, definitely, totally agree with you. I've been a walking brain most of my life, so I need a lot of areas. Lisette, I think this is the best start to make a change, that you are aware of this. So the evolutionary perspective that humans think in an intuitive way, intuitive dualistic way, Kath, I think, as I said, it on the slide where I was introducing the theory of mind, so that the that the ability to distinguish between the mental features of another person and the physical world, I think this was just helping the people to survive. So when there was another person walking towards you and you were just seeing this person but not imagining what he might have in mind, so I don't know if that was a person from a different clan or whatever, I think the understanding that he might have different goals than you have was very crucial in that way, that they were able to survive. And also to for example, to tell other people where they can find food from your own clan. So if you are not aware that other people don't know the same things as you know, like the Sally who went away and didn't know that the Anne was putting the ball into the box instead of the basket. So if you don't know what the other people know, it's hard to explain new things and get on that part. So I hope that was a short answer, but more in my master thesis. So I'm happily sending it over.
Yeah, so Alina just answered, can an evolutionary perspective explain why that human thing in an intuitive, dualistic way, right? That was the answer to it?
Yeah, exactly.
I think not everybody caught that, so I just want to make sure people know.
Thank you. So yeah, this is definitely one part. So I think it would be interesting to dive deeper into the evolutionary perspective on this. So also knowing now that science is telling us, okay, our mind and brain are super interconnected and dependent on each other, but that we still are acting in a more dualistic way, and that it might be good to kind of outgrow this intuitive belief and replace it with explicit knowledge, which you just gained here, to be healthier and to have more well-being and all this. So I think it's very interesting to dive deeper into that, definitely. And I think evolution is having a great deal on this too.
What about Einstein, who said that the intuitive knowledge is the, you know, the greatest knowledge, or how did he phrase that? So I'm wondering, what if humans would have used more their intuitive thinking? Wouldn't they be more advanced nowadays?
I could imagine. I think it's a great part, and this is also where I want to tap into with my coaching, that we should get back to the wisdom of our body. So I think our body really knows so much, but we're so in our head and in our doing and in our driving mode that we want to reach something and have these goals and need to work for it. And I mean, society tells us as well, right? So only if you use your mind and your intellect, and then you can reach something and have a good life and can earn money and all this. But I mean, this is not true, right? So what makes up a good life? I guess this is super connected to our body, where we feel comfortable, what our body tells, okay, this is good, this feels right. And I think, going back into our body and really listening to what our body says, this could really help in so many ways. And I think Einstein here was also tapping onto this, that the greatest ideas come when you're not thinking about it. So, right, so the solution can't be found with the same mind who made up this problem. So I really believe that when you, I'm sure you know these situations, when you go for a shower and then you just get the idea because you stop thinking about it. So the whole thing was settling in your body, and when you are in the shower, you're washing yourself. So you're taking care of your body and feel yourself. So there come great ideas. So I really believe that we could be in a different state right now if we would have listened more to our body, but it's never too late. So we can always start. I think today is a great day to do so.
So it's also like that implicit and explicit learning. The way of learning we have been taught at school was very explicit, dualistic, right? But if actually it has been also shown in some studies that implicit learning can be very beneficial. So Adrian is saying as well here that we need more embodied practices to overcome our intuitive dualism. And where do you think those practices should be implemented, and how? Do you have any recommendations for that?
You mean to stay more embodied?
Yeah, like embodied practices, like when they should be started and how. I mean, because children have this, you know, certain age, you know, limits, 4 and 10. So do you recommend to start very early on, or how would you see that? What is your stance on that?
I definitely feel that it would be perfect to start early. So, I mean, the children are so much learning from the parents, and if they are supported and encouraged to really feel and experiment with their body and why they're growing up. I mean, of course, at one point there comes the age where they go to school and get all this knowledge, which is great as well, if they find a way to integrate it with the body. So I read this study where it was said that when kids are getting information, for example, from TV, they should then, after 1 hour of watching TV, they should be at least 3 hours out in nature in order to really integrate this information and to balance out all this cognitive load they just got. So I really do believe that it's all about finding a good balance and the support from the parents to help the children to find a way of how to integrate the knowledge in order to make it meaningful for them, so they will learn better in a way as well. Because when it makes meaning and they find this, the purpose and the sense behind what they just learned, then they integrate it and then they keep it for life. So I guess it definitely makes sense to start as early as possible with this.
Thank you so much, Alina. Muriel is also saying we should start with babies, and then we should, do something like activities like massage, dancing, climbing trees, cooking together with kids. So
definitely, yeah.
So much to do in this, subject. I mean, the subject can be used for so many areas, with children, with adults, in so many ways.
Definitely, yeah.
So this is a very important subject area. I'm really happy we had the chance that you presented in our conference.
Thank you so much.
How can we forget our body? So we should definitely, apply what you recommended us today. I am so thankful you presented. I'm so thankful for everyone who attended. And we have also Lisette saying that she really enjoyed this, and she's thanking you very much. And
Thank you so much. Happy to hear.
A lot of positive feedbacks. So I'm really happy for that. So everyone, this presentation is still available for 48 hours on our portal and also Facebook. So do recommend it to your friends. It's really important that we get to know more about this nowadays, especially in our disembodied world. And do not forget, we have the option of buying the whole library. Actually, it will give you more chance to digest this whole content, because we have so many amazing topics and you have lifelong access. So I would recommend to buy it now, because it will double in price after the conference. And we also created learning lists, which make it easier to navigate through the very dense content of this conference. Yeah, again, so I would like to ask you, Alina, top tip embodiment for today.
Top tip embodiment. I guess for me, it definitely is to stay curious. So to not only say, okay, I know how this plant feels like, or I know how it is to walk this rocky path or whatever, and not do it because you know it, but rather to be curious. So when something catches your attention, to go there, to feel it, to touch it, to really look at it. So to stay curious and use all your senses to experience, even though you might know what it is like. But you can always find something new in the everyday experience. So stay curious, everyone, and use your body to explore.
Thank you so much, Alina, for this. And definitely stay on our channel. We have so many more amazing talks today. So our next talk at 10 a.m. UK time is with Dr. John Danvers, and about interwoven nature, relatedness, and identity in a changeful world. And then we have Dr. Patrick Curry about enchantment, ecology, and embodiment. And Patrick covers afterwards with Ecosoma, a participatory somatic experiment for disabled and non-disabled movers. Please join us. It's going to be amazing today. So I would like to thank everyone for making this possible, Alina for presenting, Adrian for being here, our amazing manager, and join our coffee breakout rooms. There you can exchange more between you and also meet, you know, more amazing people. Yeah. And join our Ecology and Research Facebook group so you can get more information about everything.
Thank you so much, everyone. It was a pleasure being here, and I'm looking forward to discuss this more with you in the Facebook group.